You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome in, welcome in. The Bite Me podcast is on the air and in your truck, in your home, wherever you're listening right now. We appreciate it. John Lopez here, Captain Scott Knoll there, and so is Captain Caleb McCumber. We got Caleb, our field reporter, so to speak, is out there getting stuff done in beautiful Louisiana, I believe. And we'll get all the details on that in just a second. But, of course, definitely want to get through some of these things because we've been really lucky getting a bunch of new listeners just about every single week. And that's awesome because we get people that want to talk some fishing, maybe learn a thing or two, maybe share some topics with us, et cetera. And we will get to all that. So we want to make sure that you have all the particulars of what we're doing. And the particulars are this, very simple. And we'll get into the rest of the topics. You can ask those questions and topics anytime you'd like. And that can be via the Bite Me group page on Facebook. Easy to join. Just search Bite Me. You'll find it. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast. If somebody shared it with you, somebody told you about it, we appreciate them. We appreciate you. Just go to iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast, anywhere you can get a podcast. This one is going to be on the air. So, boys, let's get right into it because, you know, I don't like to waste a lot of time. We've got a lot of ground to cover, a lot of water to cover, so to speak. We're going to talk about the perfect wade. I actually just got a question, a second question on this right before we started recording this podcast. So we'll get to that as well. Upper, middle, and lower coast. This sounds very simplistic, very rudimentary, but the question I got was, y'all talked last week, and we did, about the potholes and, you know, how that's distinguishable for the lower coast and how to fish them, and they appreciated that, and we appreciate the nice words. So the question was, let's say I think he was in Victoria. No, not Victoria. And so some South Texas town, and he says, you know, I usually go south, you know, to the lower coast. Let's say I go to the middle coast. Why is that different? What do I need to know? Upper coast, why is that different? What do I need to know? We're going to hit that with a couple of guys that have been all around the Texas coast, more so than I have, to be exact. I think there's some other really fun discussions to be had about the intercoastal canal, or as we call it down in Matagorda, the ditch. A lot of times you just barrel through the ditch, so to speak. Scott and I have had this conversation probably close to 2 years ago now about, you know, there are things to look for, things to find. You know, don't just put your blinders on and just barrel down that that ditch. There are some fish to be had, and I think this time of year might be really, really good. Interesting boat ramp confessional that scared the heck out of me because there's no way I could do it. And we are in officially early trout, fall trout pattern. What is that? And a lot more for you, but we got to start with Caleb. Your surroundings look slightly different than the last time we had you on a Zoom call. Explain yourself.
Yeah, Jim Cantori here.
Exactly.
The hurricane has officially arrived in South Louisiana.
Yeah.
I am sitting in a Jayco travel trailer. You can see my JH boat parked right out the window.
I can.
Right beside me are some bayous off of what they call Mr. Go, which is the Mississippi River something outlet. It's a it's a big chunk of water that splits up a lot of the marsh here in South Louisiana. And I've got little Steve with me, and there's a 14-foot alligator about, I don't know, 20 yards behind me just floating around in the water. So Steve and I have had a talk about that.
Steve, stay where you are.
Yeah, don't move, Steve. yeah, it's been a travel day for us in typical tournament fashion, and my ability to remember things. I thought we were leaving Wednesday morning. yeah, that's a whole different topic.
Can you update on when you exactly left?
We left at 4:30 a.m. from Cypress, Texas this morning. We got down here. We wanted to get here early, get packed, get set up, be ready to go. In the back of my truck, we brought two trucks and two boats. In the back of my truck is a pellet smoker, two Weber grills. I actually have a freezer, a deep freeze in the back of my truck that is full to the top with food. Anybody that's ever been to Hopedale, Delacroix area, there is nothing here. Myself, before I ever came, and I'm sure a lot of people, they kind of picture a Venice or a Port O'Connor. Jack. It is a crummy boat ramp, a little bit of fuel, an obnoxious, absurd amount of houses for the sustainability of going to get a bag of Doritos around this joint. It's 20 miles to the nearest food around here. So we brought a bunch of food with us this time. Out in front, I have a picnic table with a 42-inch TV, a hacked Android TV box that's wired into my iPad so they can watch the Astros tonight.
What a baby.
Daniel brought no less than 7,000 bags of chips. I've got cashews, peanuts, mixed nuts. We are set. If the world ends, me, Steve, and this Jayco and Daniel, we're going to be okay.
You know, we talk often on this podcast about not overpacking.
I've got four bags. I'll admit it. I'll wear the same T-shirt for a week. I could not care less. But I have four bags with me. I have a bag full of shorts and T-shirts and stuff. I've got a bag full of Grundon's rain gear, which you can buy at FTU, by the way.
There you go, baby.
I've got two bags full of fishing clothes. I brought two caps. You know, you got to have your going out cap and your fishing cap, right?
Hey, your dress cap.
That's it. But we left this morning at 4:30. We hit the lower Ninth Ward.
Okay, so why are you there, in case anybody didn't listen to last week's podcast?
Oh, we're here for the Redfish World Series. It's a four-day tournament. Got to catch a lot of them, and it's quite simply the best guys out there. It's the top 55 teams you can find. We have to catch two fish day one, three fish day two, I think four fish day three. I probably should check on that. And then they cut it, and then the last day, the top 12 teams move on for, I think, $100,000 payday. I think there's $200,000 paid out at this thing. This is my first year to be in it. I'm really happy to be here. Daniel and I wanted to get down there early, get set up, ready to go. We took a shortcut through the lower Ninth Ward, which was great. Got down here at 11:30, and they told us that we would not be able to move into our RV until 3 p.m., So it's good that we got up and got down here early, but Daniel did point out we missed a bunch of traffic. So I'm not going to beat up on him on that. But I think I have 15 rods in the back of my truck. I hope to come home with two or three of them. And I told y'all before the show that Daniel bought me a very special present, and he handed it to me right before we started recording. I said, "What's this?" He said, "It's yours." I said, "What do I owe you?" He said, "It's yours." And it is. I don't know why he would do this, but he bought me a VHF emergency radio. This thing floats. Okay. I mean, it's Caleb proof.
Well, there's two parts of that story. And Scott, I want to get to you because you're grinning the whole time. You've lived this life, and I know I want to get your stories. But there's two parts of that gift that are very, very important. I think the most important part of that gift that Daniel gave you, your partner, by the way, for those who don't know, Daniel is your partner. Number one, that you didn't have one in the first place after all the things you've done. And number two, it floats, which tells me Daniel knows you quite well. But just one more background thing, because no pressure, by the way, Caleb, but we are all going to be watching very, very closely and pulling for you. So no pressure to produce this. I guess it's in 2 weeks in this tournament.
It's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday of Halloween weekend.
Okay.
There actually is a story with this VHF radio and why I didn't have one. The Matagorda locks operator, I know his number, it's on speed dial. And every time I call, Rick answers the phone. And I say, "Hey, Rick, what's the situation of the locks?" He says, "Do you have a radio?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "That's what you need to use to talk to me." I said, "Rick, I'm talking to you on the phone right now. It's very easy." So Rick and I have this thing going back and forth, but he's going to be pleasantly surprised. I don't even know what channel it is. So, hey, somebody messaged me telling me what channel the locks are on this thing. But I can't wait to talk to Rick telling me he finally won.
Scott, you're grinning the whole time Caleb's talking about that. You have lived that life for several years. I want to go back to the start of it. It's better to be prepared for every possibility But our guy Caleb certainly seemed to bring everything, maybe even including the kitchen sink there. And then your thoughts on just what it takes, because this is a process that people think, oh yeah, hey, those guys showed up, went fishing, caught a bunch of fish, had some fun, and won some money. It doesn't work that way, does it?
No. And my travel partner was Dean. Mm-hmm. So that was
That's even better.
That's why Dean kept lighter. Dean probably brought less, I'd imagine.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Dean just kind of winged it. You know, hey, I got my, you can hear Dean say it. I got my paddle. I got my kayak. I got two rods and reels. I got some lures. We're good. And that was about it. But yeah, we traveled all over South Florida like that, all the way down to the Everglades. And the difference was we had to go and catch snook and snook, redfish, and trout. And we, you know, every tournament was a three-peat. You know, you had to get all three in order to do well. That just puts a whole different level on it. And but just trying to catch redfish in Florida is tough. They do a thing, they call it dead sticking. They'll take gulp, and they got all that grass around there, and they go up to a pier, and where that pier is sitting and there's no grass underneath it, they'll throw that gulp into that dead spot up under that pier, just let it sit. And they call that lure fishing somehow, but it's more like bait fishing.
Oh, that's crazy.
It works.
Yeah. I have quite a large selection of gulp, and I am quite famous for dead sticking. It's actually a really good technique over here, and it's not so much what Scott's talking about. It works really well in Corpus, where you throw that gulp out and let it sit in a sand spot. But over here, we'll find real finicky redfish that don't really want to eat, and I'll have to lay it in front of his nose and just let it sit there and maybe just jiggle it a little bit. But yeah, like Scott said, there's a lot that goes into it. I know of at least 10 teams that were here this time last week, and we're scattered out about 200 miles right now. The tournament launches out of Hopedale, and there's people in Venice. There's people way west of Venice. We are scattered out big time, to the point where out of 55 boats, I may be able to fish all day without seeing another boat, you know, in a lot of these areas.
And Scott, you know, we have such a wide variety of listeners and fishermen with, you know, wide variety of experience. I don't think people understand fully. Some don't, you know, how these tournaments work. He just talked about being spread out. 10 times out of 10 in tournaments like this, you have to put in and put out in the same area. They have these times where you go out and do your fishing. You know, what kind of challenges does that bring, you know, for the competitors? Because another thing that people don't understand, you didn't do it in your kayak, and maybe Caleb can follow up, you know, with this, but you can put in and let's say, what'd you say, Hopedale, Caleb, you know, right? And then run 50, 60, maybe even more miles away.
Yeah. I mean, in the kayak tournament, it was different. We would drive that far. I mean, all the only real rule was that we had to put in at a public launch. We couldn't go to some private, you know, go through somebody's yard and launch, you know, in some private place. It had to be a place where everybody could launch. But I did the boat tournament thing too. And we did it in my little poling skiff a lot so we could get way back into these back areas. So you didn't really want to make a big long run, you know, the way a lot of these guys are doing these days. And even back then, everybody was doing it. You know, we'd have a Galveston tournament, and there'd be guys fishing Sabine, Matagorda, all over the place. You have to figure out how much fishing time you need in a day and how much travel time you can allow. It's a fine line. You know, if the bite, you know, the bite's going to be early, you're really pushing it if you're going to try to run a long, long ways and then get on that bite real quick and then get all the way back. My theory on it was we were driving past a lot of fish. You know, a lot of those guys were driving past a ton of fish. So we stopped and fished the fish that were closer. And we had one out of Clear Lake where we were supposed to launch out there and go out the channel at Clear Lake. And we turned around, we went out and launched, and we went past the check station at the end of the little pier there. Mm-hmm. And then we did a U-turn and went right back up into Clear Lake and went into the back end, Taylor Lake and some of those places. That's where all our fish were. And everybody else was running all over the place. We were fishing within sight. We could see the Ferris wheel.
Caleb, the balance there, and you guys know, I've just done, you know, a few tournaments a year, and they're not, you know, big money tournaments like what you guys have done and did and are doing. But the balance there for me is always intimidating. Like, let's say I know, you know, I can find my, you know, some redfish or whatever it is, trout at this particular place. But do I really want to risk an hour, 2 hours, or whatever it is? How do you figure that out? Don't get, you know, do anything against the rules for this particular tournament. Just go back into some of the tournaments that you've been, you know, how do you figure out where I want to go and how much of a risk I want to take?
Well, it's an experience thing. It really is. And, you know, I want to make it clear that I'm no tournament guru. I've weaseled my way into a couple of pretty cool ones and got lucky here and there. I'm going to go where I'm comfortable spending a lot of time at. Now, there's situations where, you know, you'll run 4 hours one way. But like Scott was saying, you know that you have an hour or two to catch your fish and get back. But if you're doing that, you're running to a high percentage area that has good stuff in it. I'm always going to try to stay close if I can. We want to find something within 20 miles of the launch here. That's what we really want to do. Are we going to have to run 100 miles? It's quite possible. The tournament that Daniel and I won in Sabine, I think it was 80 miles one way, but those ponds had proven themselves in our practice fishing. And I knew that once we got there, we didn't have to do any more running. One of the things that I tell a lot of people that reach out to me for some crazy reason about tips for tournament fishing is it has nothing to do with like fishing with your buddies on Saturday. Tournament fishing, a high percentage of it is time management, period. You know, knowing how to make the most out of every single minute of your day. And like Scott was saying, sometimes that bite window is early. Pat and I, the legends in Corpus Christi a couple of years ago, Pat and I had it won hands down easily. We had been on fish that were averaging 7 and 8 pounds, and these are all trout. And those particular fish had won the last three tournaments in a row for the last 3 weeks in a row. We knew those fish. And a fog delay that morning put us there 45 minutes late because they had slid off every morning at 9 a.m. We got there about 5 minutes after nine. I think the second cast, Pat caught a big one. And then Pat moved out to the drop off while I tried to get into the good stuff. And Pat caught the last big one of the day on the drop off. We got there right as they were moving away. So it's hedging your bets. It's gambling. It's trying to make the smart move. Sometimes it works. A lot of times it doesn't. Whenever you see these big guns, like the guys that are down here coming in with nothing, it isn't because they aren't good enough to go catch fish all day. They were hedging their bets on what they thought it took to win the tournament, and some timing got them, some tide got them, something got them. But they were going to where they wanted to go for a particular reason. So I'll close with, when you are tournament fishing, you know, make a plan and stick to it. You know, there's mornings where you wake up and the tide did something wonky or the wind did something wonky, and you have to make last minute calls. But at the end of the day, you know, make a plan, stick to it. And if you don't catch your fish in the first 2 hours, don't panic and bounce around and run around. You know, you can go watch the YouTube video that I put up of me and Daniel at that tournament in Sabine. We didn't have our fish caught until 15 minutes before it's time to come home, but we stayed with that plan all day.
Now, Scott, we do have a lot of tournament fishermen like myself that mainly do, you know, smaller charity stuff. Also some very experienced fishermen here. When you are scouting, and I'm going to let Caleb decide if he wants to weigh in on this, because, again, we want to make sure he's all good to go for the World Series. Do you just start closest to the launch area and just, you know, kind of go in a certain direction, or is there a strategy to scouting? You look at weather. Do you look at tidal patterns, when a tide is hitting a certain area? That's what I've done in the past. Like, okay, the tide is here at this hour, you know, today and tomorrow when I'm fishing or whatever, and it's here, you know, 3 hours later, 3 hours earlier. You know, guys want to, and this extends not just to tournaments. It's like maybe, you know, increasing your odds to catch fish, period, on a given day. How do you, like, scout, let's say, a 50-mile, we'll keep it simple, you know, sort of target zone that you want to fish?
I know what my fish are doing, and I'm going to look for areas that are similar to that. And like he said, comfort. You know, what you're comfortable fishing. I like marshes. You know, I like fishing rivers and I like fishing marshes. If either one of those is available to me closer to that ramp, then that's where I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. I'm not a deep water guy. You know, there's a bunch of deep water specialists and it didn't do me any good to go out there and roam around in the middle of East Bay or the middle of Trinity and look for those deep water schools. I got it. That wasn't in my game plan. It's mm-hmm. not my wheelhouse. You know, I'm just not going to, I don't feel comfortable doing that. So know what you like to do and know what you're most comfortable catching fish doing, and then start working from there using a map, using Google Earth, then start putting your time on the water. Google Earth is the way to go. Always was for me. We were fishing places in Florida we had no clue about. And we learned real quick what type of areas we liked and what type of areas we wanted to stay away from. There was a whole lot of guys over there fish docks. We just didn't do well on docks. Mm-hmm. So we fished a lot of more backwaters. The canopied areas where the mangroves were making complete canopies and had shade all day long. We could catch fish in those all day. You know, it wasn't a morning or an evening thing. You had that lower light in there and you'd have good tide movement going through there. So we would look for, do a lot of scouting on Google Earth before we'd ever even get there. And then that narrowed it down to half a dozen places we needed to go check during that week that we were pre-fishing.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Caleb, how do you approach the day before, the week before, whatever, when you're trying to target, okay, this is the area I need to find where some fish are?
It's fairly similar to what Scott said. We all have our different strengths. Mine, I truly believe that if I find water where I can see the fish, I can compete with anybody out there. One of the things that I'm gifted with is I can see them before they see me a lot of the time, and I can hit my cast. I'm good at that. So what I'm going to be doing over here, I'm going to probably stay in the marsh. I got cut off from being able to speak with anybody outside or inside the tournament a week ago. The 12th was the last day we could talk to anybody. But before that, I heard that the water was pretty dirty over here. There's certain things that happen in this marsh. I'm moderately experienced over here mm-hmm. in this particular area. So I know several places and scenarios where it really doesn't matter how dirty the water gets. The water is going to be clean there. So the first thing I'm doing is I'm going to find stuff that matches my game. I want to find what I know I can confidently do. If it turns out that stuff's off, then I'm going to have to adapt and change, and I'm going to have to fish those dirtier windblown shorelines. I'm going to have to fish that deeper water. But what I really want to do is I want to go find clean water where I can see some fish and pick them out. That's the number one goal for about the next 4 or 5 days, is just checking all those places that should have stayed clean.
That's really good stuff. And again, I don't think it necessarily applies to just tournament fishing. Want to talk about this question we got about the perfect wade, which is obviously a good time to remind our listeners, the Bite Me community, if you will, about coastalfishinggear.com, the Wade Wright belt, the Wade Wright sling, and the terrific, terrific things that they have for our listeners. That's another reason to want to be a part of the group page, and that is go to coastalfishinggear.com. It is wade season right now. It's always wade season, but especially right now. So you can get, use the promo code BITEME20, one word, BITEME20, and you get 20% off the entire package. You can go to the website and get more details, but it's the Bite Me combo there. So while speaking of wade fishing, Caleb, you know, the perfect wade, the question, I won't read the whole thing, but the question is more about from like the gear that are necessities, especially right now with the cooling weather and the cooling water more specifically. And when you're, you know, we always talk about what you're looking for, And let's say people, you know, listening here, you know, have found where a place where they want to wade. But I think what he was talking about was from the gear to, you know, actually wading. You know, he was talking about he and his three buddies, which so there's four people wading. We've touched on this a little bit, but how would you sort of, you know, put the group out there in terms of where you start with depth, where you start with, you know, separation, how, you know, we always talk about going slow. So I'm not going to repeat that, but everything from getting set up for the perfect wade to actually, you know, conducting, so to speak, the perfect wade.
Assuming I don't know exactly where the bite is, I just know an area.
I think that's what he's talking about. Yeah.
Right. Pat and I do this quite often when we fish together, and Pat's the guy that always goes up really, really shallow. And then I start out deeper. I'm usually a good ways out deeper than Pat is. And then we just kind of zigzag back and forth. And, you know, we're not really within talking distance of each other, but we could definitely watch each other and see what's going on. And if I see Pat locked down and really start fishing an area, then I might start sliding towards him or vice versa. You know, different tides, different water temperatures, all kinds of stuff. Those fish, they might have been 100 yards off the bank yesterday whenever you found it or whatever. They could slide up real skinny, or they can move from skinny to further out. So we do split up and try to fish, you know, different depths, no doubt. Pat might go to grass while I go to, like, some shale that's in the area, or a drain, or a deeper spot, or something like that. But it's all about trying to hit all the differences in that area until one of you pick it up. If you have four guys, then, you know, it's easier to do. You can spread out where you have a guy shallow and then a little bit further out, a little bit further out, a little bit further out, and kind of move your way down the bank. I wouldn't everybody just jump out all in the same spot and just go to fishing. You know, I would definitely try to spread out and go that way.
Scott, how are you? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. He had asked about gear, but I
that's what I was going to ask.
I didn't want to get too spread out on that topic. Man, I've said it a million times. I travel light. I travel as light as I possibly can,
except to Louisiana.
well, my truck and my shoulders are two different animals. You know, I don't drag a net. I always have bogas. If I'm wearing waders, I'm rarely have on a wading belt. I don't carry stringers, so there's no need for that. And then just an over the shoulder box, you know, the wade right box, or however you want to do it. But as far as the lures, man, I see people get out, and there's nothing wrong with it, I don't guess, but I see people get out and they'll have 25 quirkies and 400 plastics and 15 topwaters.
Yep, you're preaching.
yeah. you know, I have, you know, two or three quirkies, maybe 5 or 10 plastics, 2 jig heads and a topwater. And that's all I take. I think it keeps you a little bit more focused and keeps you a little bit more grindy with that lure, but you do have, you know, you have the ability to change the plastic, change the top water, or something like that. I think when you have so much in your box that you're spending a lot of the time messing with your own head, trying to decide what you want to change to, maybe this will work, maybe that'll work. And, you know, it might be, you just haven't put it in front of her nose yet.
You know, Scott, you know that's, I feel very strongly about that. You're not on an expedition. You know, you're not Lewis and Clark. You know, you don't need to have sandwiches and beers and waters and, you know, your whole tackle box. I'm totally with Caleb on that. I know you're advocate of that as well. But, you know, when you're getting out and wading, you know, I always, this is where I'm totally different, because I fish with Pat Gardner. That's who Caleb was referencing there. I can't help myself but wanting to cast. So as soon as I get in the water, I'm casting. A lot of guys just go straight to the shoreline and it works. You know, Patrick's one of the best wade fishermen I've ever seen in my life. Getting real, real shallow, ankle deep practically, and working that way. But the other thing I like to do, and I want to get your thoughts just on all this, Scott, is I like to start casting as soon as I get out of the water, because no matter where, how well I know a particular area, you can just get those reminders of what the bottom feels like as you're working your way toward the shore, or as you're working your way toward one direction or another. And you kind of get in your mind, you know, what the bottom feels like, shell to mud, mud to shell, deep mud, soft mud, hard mud. And it gives you a kind of a mental image. Even when you're coming back, you're like, okay, I kind of walked through that area that would probably be pretty fishy. I might have scared some fish off, so I'm going to go back this other direction and hit that area better. So that's That's one of my strategies of why I immediately start casting as soon as I get in the water.
Okay. Catch fish if your lure's not in the water.
Right.
So might as well start casting, you know. One of the things when you're selecting those lures and you got your buddy that's going to go fish with you, make sure you got the same lure that he really likes to throw, because that lure is going to get real expensive about 400 yards from the boat.
Yeah.
When he starts catching fish and you're not, I've had that discussion many, many times.
What do I owe you?
Yeah. How much is it for that gold spoon? Uh-huh. Oh, you didn't bring one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I can make me some money here.
Oh, man, I can't even tell you how many times I've been in that just boat, so to speak.
Go light, you know, like he's talking about. Don't bring everything with you. I'll typically bring, you know, a couple of topwaters, handful of soft plastics, you know, a light color and a dark color and a few jig heads, maybe a couple of different weights. But truly do pay attention to what your buddy's going to be throwing, and know what his favorite thing to throw is, and make sure and pack one or two of those. Because if you're going out there and you don't get on fish your way, and you look over and he's getting on fish throwing what he likes to throw, it'd be real handy to have something.
Handy.
Yeah.
I told a story last week when we were talking about, whenever we were catching all those big trout on the purple swim baits, you had to have those. That wasn't completely true. I think the second or third day we were on those fish, one of my buddies stopped in, the old, good old Blake Burnside from the CCA. I'm going to call him out. He stops in and he's throwing just a generic old quirky fat boy, black back and silver sides. And, you know, we had kind of waved him in. You come fish with us, buddy. You know, we all live in the same town. We're all good friends. And he gets out and he comes up there and, man, he throws out and something just waylays this quirky, right? And he reels it in, he throws it back out and wham. And we still don't know what he caught. He never turned it. It just ran drag and then bip, got off. And I said, hey, Blake, and I can see his pockets. They're bulging. Anybody that has fished for a long time can look at a Sims jacket, at those big old sandwich bag front pockets, and tell when it's full of quirkies, right? I look over at Blake. I'm like, hey, man, you got one of them quirkies? He looks at me, goes, nope. And I, you know, I kind of laugh. I'm like, yeah, okay, okay. And then it got silent. And it was 30 seconds of me going, waiting for him to go, here's what. He never did it. He never, nope. And just kept fishing, man.
You're on your own, big fella.
Yeah. So whenever I say you had to have a purple lure to catch them, you had to, because that's the only thing you're going to get your hands on out there that day.
It is interesting, you know, the games people play, so to speak, out there. Now, last thing, and before we move on from waiting, you know, Caleb, when you, well, both of you, but Caleb, I'll start with you. When you're waiting, this is just to reiterate, we've talked about this, anybody that listens to the podcast, but I just feel like this is so important that so many people don't do. And you just get a hit. I mean, just a hit, a good hit. Well, I'll just let you say it. What do you do?
I'm locked up. Yep. I'm there for a long time, especially if the water's cold. If the water's cold, I'm really there a long time. And it might not be so much as I'm waiting on that fish to come back as it is those fish usually aren't by themselves. Maybe it's signaling that fish are starting to come in there. You know, if I'm in a drain, I had a heck of a day one day where we had, I think, 10 fish up to 32. I got there at 6:30 in the morning and I did not catch my first fish until after lunch. It just looked right. Everything felt right. And, you know, like you said, about 1 o'clock, boom, and, missed it. Nothing. 1:30, boom, and I caught one. And then at 2 o'clock, it just came alive.
Mm-hmm.
So especially if the water's cold. Now, if it's springtime, summertime, something like that, where, you know, if there's fish in the area, they should be eating and I get a thump, I'm still going to lock up, but I'm probably not going to give it more than 10 minutes without getting another bite. But in the wintertime, I'm probably going to hang out for a good long while.
That's Patrick Gardner's wheelhouse. Sometimes I'm like, dude, that's enough.
What you're not telling everybody, though, is Pat is an absolute freak of nature. There is something special about that guy. You know, I talk about sight casting redfish out of my $100,000 tower boat. that fool can be ankle deep in water and sight cast trout 30 yards away from him.
Yeah.
We were fishing a tournament years ago, and man, it was the last second. We had to get in. It was out of Port O'Connor. We had started way over in East Matagorda Bay, and we needed one more good fish. On our way home, we stop over like behind like the Greens Airport area there in West Bay, just kind of a Hail Mary. And honestly, what we were trying to do is upgrade our redfish. Our redfish was pathetic. That is probably the only tournament I've ever weighed in a redfish and worried about it measuring on the short side. Right. you know, I think we had 3 5-pound trout, and we had our redfish weighed, I think it weighed under 2 pounds and was still somehow 20 inches. It was terrible. and so if anybody knows that area, from Greens all the way down to the concrete wall, there's this sandbar that in the wintertime you really can't get over it, right? So Pat went to the other side of that sandbar, and he's just walking. He's just going. And Donnie and I, we were fishing around there. And this was the second tournament I'd ever fished with Pat. I really didn't know the guy. You know, Nick Mosley, that was his cousin. Nick had vouched for him. He's a good fisherman. And in the first tournament, Pat had really done well and proved himself. So, I mean, we believed in the guy. But so Pat's over there. The weigh-in's at 4, and dude, it's like 3:42, right? and we did really well in the first tournament, so we're in it for team of the year. I'm really worried about getting there late, and last second, this dude just takes off. I mean, he is walking down the grass line towards Port O'Connor. I can't go pick him up in the boat because I can't get over the sandbar, and he's out of earshot. We're yelling, he's not hearing us, and I'm telling Donnie, and I mean, I love Pat. We're basically brothers now. So I'll say this. I looked at Donnie. I said, what is this kid doing? This idiot is going to make us miss weigh-in. I mean, I'm freaking out. Pat walks like 300 yards and it looks like he's like trying to get a deer with a stick and a, you know, caveman style. Right. And he finally gets in him and he casts out, and this dude hooks up and it whitewaters in front of him. And, he had been stalking a trout that far and caught it. I'm just blown away.
I can vouch for everything you were saying. As you guys know, I've known him since he was 4 years old, and I consider that, Scott, I consider that one of my strengths. I can see, you know, in the water pretty well. You know, shout out to the Costa Glasses, by the way, as well. But I don't even hold a candle to him. I mean, the way it works. I don't know if you have anything to add on this before we move on, Scott. But those are the things that you have to do, is just plant.
Yeah, just get stuck, you know. watch everybody else in the line too. You know, you inevitably, you know, I'd have a group of guys out and we're wading and we hit fish. All right, everybody stop. Well, one guy starts creeping. You know, every cast they make another 2 steps, and they make another 2 steps, and they make another, before long he's way out in front of you and he's blown the fish out. So pay attention to what your buddies are doing. And don't be the guy that creeps out there.
Don't be that guy.
Into the fish.
Don't be that guy.
Always, Scott, there is.
Sometimes I've been that guy. No, just kidding, but not really.
You don't know you're walking forwards a lot of the time. It just happens. You don't know you're doing it.
Well,
it just happens sometimes.
You're trying to move your feet, and all of a sudden you're moving forward. And
the waves are kind of tapping you in the back.
Yeah, you got to catch yourself. So, Scott, I feel like this is a great place for you to hop in on this discussion, this great question. You know, we tend to assume a lot that people know everything about when we say lower coast, upper coast, middle coast. But can you just give us that little fingernail sketch, so to speak, of like somebody listening to us in Oklahoma, let's say, or wherever, and they want to go fishing down here, and they're trying to find that spot, or maybe that house, that rental house or whatever. What do they need to know? We'll start with the upper coast, because we did a kind of a deep dive into the potholes and everything last week. You know, what do they need to know about if they're going to fish the upper coast, and how would you define it?
Upper coast, I'm going to call probably maybe down. What do you think, Caleb? Maybe down to the river at Colorado.
I wouldn't go with the Colorado. Yeah. No, maybe. Maybe like the Brazos River to Sabine, yeah. Maybe?
Yeah.
Cedar Lakes.
I think by definition, it's Selkirk North. Sargent North. I think it's a swing bridge North, but I still wouldn't call from Sargent to.
I don't know. You know, the Cedar Lakes are so much like a lot of the places on the upper coast. You know, a lot of, like Drum Bay and all those areas around there. So I'd include Cedar on the upper, and then start with Matagorda. and go down to Aransas Pass, the flats around 361 there as the middle. And then from the JFK Causeway down is definitely south. You know, that's lower coast.
All right. So start with the upper coast.
In my book.
If you're going blind, as you know, long week of fishing, what do they need to know?
Well, you're going to fish from dirtier water. You know, bring lures that make a little noise. Finding clear water on the upper coast it can be done certain times of the year. In the winter time, especially, you can still get some clear water. But for the most part, you're going to be fishing a little dirtier water. You're going to fish more structure. You're going to want to fish the oyster reefs or money. You know, that's always good. A lot more marshes on the upper coast. You got, man, just tons of marsh rimming most of the major bays down there, up that way. So it's a different kind of fishing, you know, that marsh fishing. You're going to be looking for redfish. If you want to go for the trout, go ahead and look at those open water oyster reefs a little bit more, maybe the jetties. You got good jetties there at Sabine. You got good jetties at Galveston. You got miles of jetties at Galveston.
Mm-hmm.
Backside of San Luis Pass. You got some good wading areas in there. Get to the middle coast, and then you get into a little more sight fishing. You can find a little clearer water on the bottom. You still got marshes. You still got areas that you can disappear off into back lakes. Lot less oysters once you get out of, you know, East Matagorda's got some oysters and West has got a few oysters. You get down to Port O'Connor, they get pretty scarce. Mm-hmm. Then you get up in San Antonio Bay, that's all it is oysters. San Antonio Bay almost fishes more like, to me, more like an upper coastal bay, fishing the oyster reefs. But then you get on down like Dean's area, it's all about the grass and drop-offs and fishing potholes and things like that. You go further south, then it gets into just miles and miles and miles of the same. I mean, everything it's the same depth. It's the same look. It's hard to fish down there if you don't know what you're doing. Just set up some long, long drifts,
mm-hmm.
and you'll run across fish. Baffin's a little different. Caleb knows Baffin better than I do. But most of what you consider lower Laguna Madre is just going to be miles of grass flats. Most of the place, if it wasn't for the intercoastal, most places you'd probably walk all the way across the bay.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Caleb, when I saw this question, and I want to get your same take on what Scott just said, but this is where my mind went. Upper coast, deeper water, probably maybe even if you're packing maybe a heavier jig head. I would, if I'm fishing as people know, I spent a lot of time fishing Sabine, you know, a lot of water movement out of, you know, bayous mostly up there. So that's what I'm looking at if I'm fishing the upper coast. And as Scott said, darker, dirtier water. What are your thoughts to start with the upper coast?
Yeah, on the upper coast, you know, definitely I'm throwing a quarter ounce jig head almost all the time.
Right.
It's deeper water. It's harder to, is even on Google Earth anything, it's hard to identify structure. So you're gonna have to key in on bait and whatnot. One of the biggest differences I see between the upper coast and the middle coast is birds in deeper water mean a lot more on the upper coast. Sabine, East Galveston, even West Galveston, birds will work most of the year and typically have something you want to catch underneath them, where Port O'Connor is more. I had a customer the other day and we drove past some birds. We were over close to Port O'Connor. And I could see him looking at him like, why is it this guy taking me over there? And I told him, I said, how many gaff top do you want to catch?
That story when I was down in Copano. I couldn't resist myself. I was taking the family and I just wanted them to catch something. And I finally turned the wheel and I'm like, just gaff top after gaff top.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's probably the biggest difference is I'll trust birds a lot more. So if you're new coming to one of these areas and you see some birds doing their thing, it's definitely something to give a shot with. But you know, like Scott was saying, you're not going to find, West Galveston's a little bit different. West Galveston has a bit of grass in it, but you're not going to find a whole lot of the big grass flats. You're going to find the muddy, the shell, you know, sand here and there. It's a totally different style of fishing to where you're really having to play into the currents and read the signs more so than your ability to see fish like you would, you know, further south.
And Scott, maybe this is just me, correct me if I'm wrong, but especially in this time of year, really into January, February, my experience on the upper coast has been a lot more mid-bay, deeper fish. And I'm guessing that, you know, in my opinion, has a lot to do with the water in the deeper areas. Would that be correct?
Yeah, if you're going for trout. Yeah. Now, the redfish, they're going to do the same thing. They're going to get as shallow as they can get and hunt in the marsh. I started off trout fishing, you know, growing up because we just didn't have that many reds. And I fished a whole lot of the deep reefs. In fact, Deep Reef was the name of one that we fished over in East Bay all the time. And we typically stayed off the shorelines most of the year and fished those 5-6 foot, 7 foot deep reefs that were scattered around. If you could find yourself a small out of the way reef, which we knew where there was quite a few of those that we just stumbled across over the years, those were honey holes because they weren't on any maps. Nobody really knew about them. And you could get fish that weren't being molested. You go out on a place like Hannah's or Deep Reef that everybody knows where it is. Mm-hmm. Those fish are getting beat up pretty good. Spring and fall, though, we'd work the shorelines. In wintertime, we'd move over into West Bay and work those coves. And, I mean, it wasn't anything to be over there fishing knee-deep water, catching trout.
Yeah, and Caleb, all right, mid-coast before we move on.
Middle coast isn't much different than the upper coast. You're still fishing, you know, for drains, oyster reefs, stuff like that. You know, like Scott was saying, you can get into the marshes and find some cleaner water. Our marshes, for the most part, most of them are a little bit scarier than the stuff down south. You know, down south, you screw up, you get stuck, you push it off or something. Up here, you're probably going to the fiberglass shop. I mean, really no other way to put it. But again, you know, even Matagorda, it'll be pretty green water most of the year, but it's not something you're seeing through. Mm-hmm. So you're still really having to pay attention to the tides and the currents, and the bait and whatnot. You know, Matagorda has both of what y'all were talking about. It's got the, you know, East Matagorda has the stuff you can wade up tighter with the drains and shell and whatnot. It really doesn't have much for grass. The middle of the bay has the 5 foot deep shell, all that kind of stuff. Then you move over to West Matagorda and it's like you went to a whole different country where it's clear water with grass beds and all that kind of whatnot. You know, I can't say that there's an answer for all of it, but I would say that if you're fishing the middle coast, be prepared to, you know, have to implement a lot more of the stuff that you've learned on this show or you've learned through experience or whatnot. As opposed to the lower coast, you're still going to have to do it, but at least you can look down on the bottom and or you can see potholes and target them and stuff like that.
And lower coast, just me speaking for myself, generally, I generally start with white, clear, light colored baits because the water is so clear. But what about, like, structure is completely different, Caleb? I mean, structure and what you're looking at. I'm not talking about potholes. We had that discussion last week, but let's say you're just fishing down there. You know, what are your kind of telltale signs?
Really, my style down there is a little bit different because I didn't learn from anybody that was down there. I just kind of had to figure it out myself. And I mean, maybe I'm lying a little bit. One of my tournament partners is from Corpus and you know, he taught us a bit down there. I like windblown shorelines and whatnot down there quite a bit. Like Scott was saying, there's miles and miles and miles of the exact same thing down there. So I really want to hedge my bets. I want to find that shoreline that has bait pushed up to it. You know, I want to find that maybe an edge of a grass bed. You know, I'm going to do stuff that where maybe it's a little bit different than that miles and miles and miles of stuff that we're looking at. Unfortunately, there's really not an easy answer for down there. And the population of fish down there was so dang good before the freeze. You could go down there and get by. Now, from what I understand, it's a bit tougher down there. I haven't been there since the freeze. But again, I'm going to find something that hedges my bet. So I'm going to find water moving between two islands or something like that, at least to get started.
Yeah, and you know, while we're on the lighter and cleaner, clearer baits, another one that our listeners need to kind of put a pin in and go to mycoastoutdoors.com, because my buddy Mike Acrylic from Knock and Tail, I just picked up several bags of the Bone Ice, which I would use down there. The Bone Ice Knock and Tail has a little knocker in the tail. It's self-explanatory. I also would recommend that you go there because it has another Bite Me 20 promo. So the Bite Me 20 promo code on mycoast.doors, if you're going to try that, you're heading down there. Mid-coast, I use these in Matagorda all the time. That's the greenback that he has there. And those are good because you can just really don't even have to work them that hard, if at all. So he's got that going for us. All right, so let's get to that. That's a good discussion. We're going to have to, you know, kind of follow up on that in a future podcast. But before we move on, I promise this, and I don't know, you know, Scott and I have talked about, especially when the sun comes up and it gets colder in the colder months, you know, a lot of times find the concrete, the steel that would warm up first. That might be a good kind of attack zone for fishing. I do that a lot. I did it more upper coast, you know, when I was at Trinity and Sabine, but I still do it some down in Matagorda where I am now, for intercoastal fishing. And I know we all do it. I do it 90 times out of 100. You know, Scott, I'm just, you know, barreling through the ditch in my mind. I have my game plan, as Caleb was talking about, and I'm going to these three places, let's say, that I have in my head. I have to catch myself, because sometimes there are things, if your head's on a swivel and you're always paying attention, there are things that you can see on the intercoastal, especially as the water starts to cool down, that might want you to put the proverbial brakes on and give it a shot. What are you looking at if you are, you know, you do see, so what would you see that would make you stop, put it that way?
If I'm polling,
not when you're polling, because that's,
I've got areas down here that are long sand flats
on the intercoastal,
right on that. Right on the drop off. And there's some grass on them. Mm-hmm. I like to find an area that's got some kind of structure, not just miles of the same. Yeah. You know, you want some little drains, some little edges that where maybe the salt grass is growing down. One of my favorite areas down here, there's a lot of salt grass growing out into the intercoastal, you know, the cord grass. The redfish will tend to move up there and be on the edge of that. The riprap, anytime I see the riprap, if it's just miles of exactly the same riprap, you can get a trolling motor and go down it and find some fish. There'll usually be a little gut right up against it where the waves from all the boats have washed it out. Throwing right onto those rocks, you know, it's concrete, but throwing right up to that concrete.
Yeah.
If you find one that's got a weird, like a washout, you know, where you've got miles and miles of this riprap, and then there's an area where maybe a barge got pushed up onto it or something, there's a deeper hole pushed into it, stop and fish that. Mm-hmm. Give that a shot. You'll find flounder in there quite a bit too this time.
Bingo. Y'all are reading my mind.
Most of the time I'm always looking for redfish, you know, on those. You'd be surprised how many redfish are just up there on those sand flats along the side of the intercoastal. It's a constant tidal movement for them. You know, even when it's a dead tide, all those barges moving by and all the bigger boats, they're constantly throwing a wake up there and moving bait, moving fish around. Stirring up the bottom. So you can fish that on a dead day in the middle of the summer and still have water movement. Mm-hmm. One of the main things I use it for is wind, honestly.
Yeah.
Down here in Port O'Connor. You know, if I've got one of those days, it's blowing 30, you know, out of the south, and my guys still want to fish, and all the open water is just blown out, and polling is going to be tough. I'll slip over there on the inside of that, get that big wall. You know, it's got those huge spoil banks all the way along there, 20 foot high, and trees on top of them. Hell, I'll go snuggle up next to that, and I can pole for miles that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we do well.
Yeah, you know, Caleb, he just mentioned the wind, and a lot of people, you know, kind of duck in there. That's how I found most of my favorite places on the Intercoastal, where we are now in Matagorda over the years, because you just, you know, you have the itch, you want to fish, or you have buddies that you want to take, or clients in your case. But one thing that I look at, and I want to get your thoughts, what would make you stop? And, you know, just to be completely honest here, most of the time when I stop in the Intercoastal and I see something, it's because I'm on my way in and I didn't miss necessarily, or I want to catch some more fish or didn't necessarily catch fish. And I'm like, well, let me try this, these spots that I like. But one thing that I'm looking at, there's oftentimes there's cliffs, you know, from, especially on the north side of where we fish, you know, there's cliffs. Some of those cliffs, you can see the same signs that Scott was talking about, kind of bleeding into the water. Well, it's going to be underneath the surface of the water too, and that's going to be sort of, you know, changes, tidal movement, things that have maybe, you know, for a reason, they've either been blown in, or, you know, the tide has taken them into the Intercoastal. So their structure there, that's one of the things I'm looking at, and that is a redfish heaven, what I'm talking about. But what are you looking at?
Yeah, we call those high banks. And you know, when Scott talks about fishing the river, we look at those high banks too. And that, I mean, they're big old wads of clay, and they will fall off and make lumps and little mounds and whatnot. I really like structure in the Intercoastal, but what usually has to come with that for me to really get in on it is a really high tide. If the tide's up real high, trees in the water, stuff like that. I've had many a day where we hung out in the Intercoastal, and every time we casted near a tree, we caught a fish. I mean, just that little kids, you know, whoever I had with me, fishing that structure, because those redfish would hang close to it. Full disclosure, in the summertime, 9 out of 10 days I'm fishing the Intercoastal. Windy, not windy, doesn't matter. If the water looks any kind of decent, I'm in it. This year's been different since the freeze. I haven't seen a whole lot of fish up around me in the Intercoastal. Or nothing like used to be anyway. Yeah. I'm hoping the next year that changes. But whenever I'm running down the ditch, I'm looking, you know, certain times of year, if there's any kind of a shad hatch, you see a little shadow. It looks like a cloud shadow. It's typically shad up there. The white snowy egrets, like Scott talks about, I see mm-hmm. those guys lined up, especially if they're lined up on riprap or something like that. I'll do that. And, you know, you and I have riprap between us. And that riprap does have several places where it's washed out, or maybe it looks like maybe a barge hit it or something.
Yeah.
And I'll go all the way down that. And like Scott said, there's typically a gut down it. And it's, man, I'm playing Russian roulette with my $1 jig heads, but I'm telling my customers, throw it right up on that riprap to get it in that gut. And, you know, me, my customers, anybody, that riprap will take it away. So if you're not losing lures, you aren't doing it right.
Absolutely. 100%. Okay. So, you know, this is a go-to that's become very, very popular. What would Scott do? What would, Caleb do? You know, Caleb, I'll start with you because you just left our area and I know you're going to be in the tournament, but you got some good ideas of what the weather is doing right now, or what the water is doing right now, in the Middle Coast. What would you do?
Yeah, whenever I was down there the other day, the water was looking pretty good. You know, the wind was pretty decent. We have some really nice favorable winds all week this week. Our barometer is not too high. It's like a 30. So I'd call that, you know, not great, not bad. You know, right in the middle of fishable stuff. It's sunny. It's cooler out. I 100% would be out in deeper water throwing jig heads over shell. And watching over my shoulder for birds to be kicking off with this cooler water and low winds. I think that the birds are probably going to make life pretty easy over there in Texas for a good while. And the fishing, I mean, really just go out there and cast, because I'm not there. Therefore, the fishing is going to be on fire and easy.
Have you seen some birds?
The birds have been popping up on the lower wind days. There was one day it blew pretty good and the birds were still working, but then it got, you know, kind of trashed and I left out of there. But almost every day that the wind has been lower in the last couple of weeks, the birds have been firing off and doing their job.
This is one of those weekends where I'm going to be out there. By the way, I am going to be fishing like crazy Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Because I am taking my brand new Warrior out, man. You guys see me out there in that ice blue Warrior, God, they did a good job. I'm telling you, Jake and JT and everybody over at the Boatyard in Kima, you guys got to go see them, because I asked them what I needed, did it all by text or phone, just got, you know, a good look at everything, and it is perfect. So I'm going to be putting it through all the pay. I'll be fishing the shallows, the deeps, the drifts, the intercoastal. They did a great job over there. But I'm definitely going to be looking for the mid-bay reefs in the middle coast where I am, Scott. What would Scott do? I know what I was going to say. And this is going to be right in your wheelhouse, Scott. I've been looking at the weather like crazy, because as we always talk about, you look at the weather and the winds and the tides several days before you go. I don't know if I really trust the wind this weekend, man, because we've got it coming from the northeast, then the east, then the southeast. And I'm like, everything from, 5 to 10 in the morning. And then I saw one that it's going to be 20 to 30 on Sunday. And I'm like, I don't know if I trust it. So you really got to kind of feel your way this weekend as far as what I'm thinking. But what are you thinking?
I'm looking, Port O'Connor's looking good. Less than 10 on Friday, right at 10 on Saturday, all southeast. Getting up a little bit on Sunday, but still not bad, 10 to 15. Our water temperature is still in the 80s down here. I looked at it for the upper coast. Yeah, it's mid-70s on the upper coast. So, like, Galveston off Redfish Island out there, it's showing 73. But down here, it's showing 81, 82 at the jetties. The little jetties at Port O'Connor.
Right.
So that front really didn't do a whole lot to knock our water temperature down much. I mean, it's better. It was in the high 80s. So fall's here. If I was fishing the upper coast, me, I'd be in the marsh. I've been posting some pictures, as my memory stuff comes up on Facebook, some of the best days I've ever had.
I saw that those videos were just awesome. They go to the group page and look at them. They were great.
Redfish just piling up on those grassy shorelines, chasing shrimp,
swimming over each other.
Yeah, that's typically what you find in the marshes this time of year. Just watch for those white birds. Down here, it's kicking up. I talked to Chuck Neiser, and he had a double-digit day yesterday. I think they had 17 on the fly, if I'm not mistaken. It's good. All the shallow water stuff is turning on. Trout, I don't pay that much attention to, honestly, on the reports. But I would imagine that you could jump out and wade pretty much anywhere you saw some slicks, saw some bait, your typical areas wherever you've fished this time of year in the past, and probably do okay.
All right, Caleb, I'm not sure yet. I don't know if you are. If you're going to be joining us next week, hopefully so. But go kick some butt, man. I know we give you a hard time, but you are one hell of a fisherman, and it's a great, great honor, dude. I'm not trying to just blow smoke at you, to be in that tournament. I know the competition could not be better. Everybody's going to be prepared. Everybody's probably already there. Go get them, man, and keep us up to date.
I appreciate it. I'm hoping that my signal came through pretty good. And I'll probably be able to be on next week as well, as long as it makes it a listenable experience.
Yeah, for sure. Captain Scott, scottnullphotography.com for your photos, which I always like to promote and support, and I know our listeners do. Hopefully they'll pick up some of your great photos. You got another big event coming up. We'll get to that maybe next week with the awards at the end of the month, but also Bite Me gear. We still have, correct me if I'm wrong, we got the buffs, we got the shirts, we got the hats, and Camille stays on top of that. Is that correct?
Yep, I just rearranged the closet the other day because it was getting a little out of hand in there.
She gets it. You arrange it.
Yeah, I kind of moved things around a little bit and made it a little easier to find some stuff. But yeah, we've got all that sitting up there with that. The Wildlife in Focus contest. The 30th is the award ceremony. And after that, I'll be able to put some more of those photos out that I had to hold back, that I had to turn in. I couldn't show to the public.
Yeah, that's going to be sweet. Put them on our page, man.
And at that point, then I can start putting them on the website, and you can order some prints, make great Christmas gifts.
That's right. And you got your sling off. You got your sling off.
Yeah, I had my appointment earlier today, and she cautiously told me that I could take my sling off. She kind of has me pegged as kind of way we peg Caleb. She says, hold on now. You don't go crazy. You know, you can, we can take the sling off now, but very, very light. Don't. And then she ended it and Camille started laughing because she was sitting behind me. We were doing it was a video in this time. And she said, and no fishing. She threw that one in at the very end and Camille just started laughing.
Did light include the 3 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot boxes of shirts that you just admitted to moving around?
Exactly.
In the closet?
Exactly.
No, we've separated them out and they're in little tubs and they're pretty lightweight.
Represent us, guys. We want to see pictures in your Bite Me gear. A lot of people down all over the coast have been sending pictures of that. That's cool. That's gas money for my boys that I'm sitting across from. And so every little bit helps. You know, we like to keep this thing going. It's always my favorite hour of the week. Any parting shots for you two?
I'm going to do what I can.
What'd you say? Somebody walk up to me the other day in Port O'Connor, and I was sitting in the truck, and he walked up there, and he says, the sling, the beard, and the FTU sticker on the back of the truck. Are you Scott Knoll? We had a great little chat.
Hide.
He listens all the time.
We can't.
It was kind of fun. Yeah.
I'm going to make you mad because we didn't get to it, but I'm going to do everything I can to leave my trailer at the ramp whenever I drive off this weekend.
Oh, trust me. That will be a significant part of next week's podcast.
Let's start with that next week.
You're learning. We'll start with it next week. You're learning the business, my man. That's a tease right there. So now you got to listen. Don't forget to register, subscribe, all the places I mentioned earlier, Spotify and iTunes and such. And don't forget to get that gear, represent, send us the pictures, and catch a bunch of fish. I don't forget the wave, man. I'm going to be all over that bay. I'll probably be 12 hours on the water. So shout at me. Send me that ice blue Freedom Warrior. I'm happy to stop by. Just wave me in, and we'll wave, we'll fish, we'll have a good time. Until then, you guys, have a great time, have a great weekend, and catch them up. We'll see you next time on the podcast.